Yeah, there it is. The Van Halen tune that I opened a podcast with that I just can't stop using. I need to switch it up, but I just think that thing's just a perfect opening for a podcast. Perfect opening song for the perfect podcast, which this one just might be. Welcome to the Racer X DirectMotocross.com podcast show. I'm your host, Steve Mathis, and this is it. To steal a cue from the Destroyer films, guys. This is it. The podcast to end all podcasts. Well, for me anyways. I'm sure there's some of you listening wondering why I'm all excited like this. And let me just put it to you this way. Take yourself back to when you were somewhere between the ages of 8 and 14. Those very interesting, young, formative years in a young man's life. And think about who was your hero and who you worshipped and who you idolized. Some of you might be saying Roy Rogers right now. Some of you might be saying the Fonz. Some people Bradshaw. Some people RJ. Some people Jeremy McGrath. Depends on your age. Maybe it was that guy that had the blonde hair in the Dukes of Hazzard. I don't know. My point is whatever you want to think about, that's what Ross Rollerball Peterson was to me. A little Canadian kid in Winnipeg, Manitoba, who only saw Ross Peterson race until I started going to Melville. But that's another story. For years, I just figured Ross was the fastest human on the planet. After all, if anybody was faster, why couldn't they beat him in Canada? So, anyways, Ross Rollerball Peterson is a billion-time Canadian champion who traveled south many times and represented Canada well. In the U.S., third overall, 87, Hangtown National, fifth overall, 87, Binghamton on a YZ400, fifth overall, 88, Red Bud. That's my point. He was a man. He did motocross in nations, European supercrosses, basically whatever would pay. The Rollerball would show up, so... He was a man in Canada. He was it. His reign of terror lasted from like 82 to probably 1993. He won everything there was, and he just was excellent. And you know, when you're a kid, you know, who knows? That's the time where you really start to look up to people. So the Ross fell on some hard times after retiring, and he talks about them in this podcast, and we were getting kind of deep at the end, but I'm glad he did. I'm glad he opened up. I didn't want to... get going on it too much, but I'm glad he did. He sounds great, though. He sounds like he's back on track and maybe, hopefully, ready to make an appearance in a race sometime in the near future. I'll tell you what, if you stay through this whole podcast, it's just full of information, so I'm begging you, stay through it. This was a really honor for me to do it. I was a little nervous calling him up. I don't know him, but luckily he had heard from me from his buddies, and he knew that I was a fan, so right away the ice was broken, and we got along pretty good. I'm happy to be able to do this for RacerX Illustrated and DirectMotocross.com. We're releasing it on the same day on both websites, as I know the Canadians who check in on DirectMotocross.com will want to hear this as well. So thanks again for listening. I appreciate it. And someone told me these podcasts are now available on iTunes, so along with the old RacerX Canada ones. So check that out. If they're not yet, they will be very soon. So if you want to sponsor this thing, shoot me an email at Mathis@RacerXIllustrated.com, and we'll try to get something going. But now, enough of me talking. I present to you Ross Rollerball Peterson. Ross Rollerball Peterson, thank you for doing the podcast show. I got to say, this is a great honor for me. I'm a big fan, and I'm younger than you, but when I was a little kid, man, you were the guy. So this is pretty gnarly for me to do this. Honestly, I'm really, really excited. So thanks for doing this.
Hey. Stevie, I'm real excited too, and I didn't know I was older than you by that much, am I?
Wow, I'm 35, so...
Oh, well then, perfect. I'm 36, and plus a couple there. No, it's an honor to be coming back and talking motocross and supercross. It's great. I miss it dearly.
Yeah, I'm like I said, this is awesome for me. So let's get started. What are you up to nowadays? You're in Calgary, but what are you doing?
Well, you know, I came back to Calgary and retired back here. I guess if that's what they want to call retirement, when you're working for nothing, there's no end to it. So I'm just looking after my real estate interests that keeps me busy. You know, keeping drains unplugged and toilets clear, but yeah. And collecting rent keeps you busy.
Do you ever show up to unplug somebody's toilet with, like, your jersey on, number one, Rollerball?
No, I never do that. But I'll tell you, a guy should have saved some of that stuff because, You know, now I think back of all the stuff that I had, and you just think it's natural you're always going to have it because you get a new set whenever you need it and new equipment every year. You wish you'd have kept all that stuff. Whoa. Now there's not much left.
Yeah, what do you have? What do you have from the old days? Anything?
Oh, I think back in the archives there, I might have a jersey maybe and a helmet. That would be about it. I was looking for a pair of pants or some goggles from a fan that I talked to that came by the other day, and I couldn't find them anything small, and the only thing I had that I knew I had was one jersey, and that was back from the Montreal Supercross days. Sort of hanging on to that for in the event I have some kids someday, if I get lucky enough, I guess.
Yeah, you know, do you remember Scott Swinehart, the Bridgestone?
Sure, I do.
He has a pair of your pants, Answer yellow and baby blue rollerball pants, and
awesome, man, that's awesome. Those just looking at stuff like that, when I see, you know, an old picture of me, I'll see those pants or a jersey or a set of goggles, and you look at them and they all tell a story. You know, you remember how this happened or that happened.
Yeah.
So I guess it's a sign of getting old. You know, you look at this stuff and it's all got stories to it.
he won't sell it to me no matter what. I've tried to buy the pants. But he will not let them go. So, when's the last time you rode? Do you still ride? Have you ridden much? What's going on with that?
I haven't rode too much, Steve, lately. Just you know, the event that we're getting some you know, plus 10 degree weather here. Now I'm going to be out, but it's been pretty cold up here. We've had some cold stretches here, minus 20 to minus 40. So the thought hasn't even entered my mind. But now that it's warming back up, we'll have to get out. And I haven't rode since last year, so I don't know. I'll be a little bit rusty when I go out there. Jimmy might have a little bit of an edge on me now.
No, he wouldn't. Trust me. What? What do you ride? Four stroke?
As I say, I do a few private motocross schools, and I'm going to get back into that this spring. I'm going to teach some schools, mainly private ones, and work more individually with the rider. I feel that will get me more back into the scene. And lately, just been going on the odd ride when I have gone out, and just usually end up getting a bike or getting sponsored from one of my buddies that have got a couple, two or three bikes, and we go up and tear it up a bit. It's kind of fun to get out there. But I'll tell you, you're out there for a lap or two on the track, and it's like, whoa, it seems like, you know, other than your speed down quite a bit, it feels like you haven't left the track, that's for sure.
Yeah, especially somebody like you who was always very aggressive out there. I imagine those feelings come back to you pretty quickly, you know what I mean? Like the aggressiveness and the wanting to ride super fast and challenge guys. So,
well, fear sets in a little more now, Steve. you know how if that old body of mine hit the ground, how it wouldn't bounce anymore like the old rollerball did. It would just break.
No, don't tell me that. Trust me. You could don't ruin my dream that you have fear. So, hey, I want to talk about like the early years when you were on a Kawasaki, like in the late 70s, early 80s. When did you start thinking to yourself, like, hey, I can make a living at this. Like, I can do this professionally. Like, at what point do you remember it ever saying to yourself, wow, I'm actually a pretty good rider?
You know, some of my friends here, Rich McAvoy and I talk, and Marshall Johnson, a couple of close friends of mine that actually got me started racing. We talk about the old days and you know, some of my heroes that I eventually ended up racing against, you know, like the Jeff Wards and the Bob Hannas. And we used to pedal our bicycles down to the local, you know, confectionery store and look at all the new mags that came in, you know, on motocross action and whatnot, and read about these guys. And then, you know, I guess it would have been about in the late 70s, you know, 79 when I had my Can-Am ride, knowing that, hey, I'm going to be racing against these guys now, you never really believe that you're as good as them because you've put them up on a pedestal for so long. You know, like I can remember many times being down with the some of the American riders, racing with Hannah or Wardy, and being with them, beside them or behind them or ahead of them in the race, and actually going, wow, I'm doing okay here. Just, be cool. Don't fall. Don't make a mistake here. You're still in awe, and you're racing with these guys. That would have happened back in about the late 70s, early 80s, mm-hmm. when I just started competing with these guys, and you all of a sudden realize that person that you put in God's place, either he'd slipped a notch or two, or things had changed. You'd gotten better, but you were racing with him. It was pretty wild.
Yeah, I bet. And when you started winning regularly in Canada, like one thing I always admired about you was that it seemed like, and maybe this was just because you were trying to chase, the most money that you could make, but it always seemed like you weren't comfortable just being the best guy in Canada. You could have just stayed home and won title after title after title, but you ventured south a lot and probably on your own dime. You know what I mean? Nobody was paying you.
Yeah.
And so it was, to me, it's interesting. Did you just want to go to the U.S. and prove yourself? I mean, was it just a pride thing, or, what made you start going down there so much?
Well, back then it was, as you say, it was coming out of our pocket or my pocket, because we were given a budget to use, and by doing a lot more races and traveling more, you spent more money, of course, which depleted your budget and the end result, money in your pocket. That's on the business aspect of things, but as far as being out there, the challenge, I'd done well in Canada, and the challenge wasn't as great as it was down in the States. So to come down there and race against your heroes, number one, and number two, you had a challenge down there. That was something I wished that I wouldn't have let, my contracts with the companies got in the way of, that I had to compete in the Canadian Series, in Supercrosses, because I would have loved to have stayed in the States and raced against the guys down there, for full seasons instead of just coming down, to warm up and the odd race during the year. I think things could have been, a lot different. And then who knows, when you're talking about time like that, right. A lot of different things could have happened, could have, should have, would have. Those are all water under the bridge, past tense. But, I would never, I guess, change anything. My career was great, and loved doing it. And, everybody would change their past at some point or another. When you're looking in hindsight, I guess, yes, I wished I would have rode even more down there. But mainly it was the challenge of competing with these, at the time, the world's best for sure. And at indoor or outdoor, and racing with these guys and sitting next to them on the line was, a dream of mine. And I was living it at the time.
You know what's funny is you sound to me that these guys were, you keep saying these guys were your heroes and you were in awe of them, but if you talk to anybody who watched you race, it seemed like you didn't give a shit who was in front of you. Like, you were just a gnarly, tough racer. So it's funny how on the track you were one way, but on the starting line you were like, holy crap, that's Hannah. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you could never let them see that, that you were, awestruck about them. But, all the top guys that I rode against down there, the guys that had come along with me up to challenge these guys, you're always in awe of these fellas, because how hard they've trained and worked to get where they're at. Nobody just handed it to them, and it was a tough sport, especially back then. You didn't have one or two tough guys. You had, you know, 20 guys there that were right there, and a lot of separation was just determined by, maybe some machinery, one having a little better this or better that, and everybody was very tough and hungry back then. So you could never show them that you were in awe of them. You had to put your wrestling face on, so to speak, and go out there and mix it up a little with them.
Yeah, hence the rollerball. And talking about your training, I mean, I talked to guys down here like Ross Maeda and even Mitch Payton. And a lot of thing that comes out with you, and even you've told me some of your stories before, like you were a training machine. Ross Maeda said that you used to get your mechanic to drop you off and you'd run to Ross's shop, you know, just for training in the middle of the day or whatever.
It got me hooked back then was, the best, Wardy and Hannah, they were all, training and, hard, they're out cycling or running, and not just out, hey, I'm going out for a 5-mile run, and show up back in 40 or 50 minutes. It was like they'd go out for a 5-mile run and come back in 30 minutes, doing 6-minute miles. This wasn't out there for to break a sweat. This was out there, mm-hmm. You created a little pain, you worked that hard, and I guess that's where the saying, no pain, no gain. And I know for me, a lot of what it was that separated us was the training, and that was my element. One of my elements of greatness was that I wasn't afraid of pain. I guess as far as the training goes, I seemed to excel with the harder I worked at it. So, I worked as hard as I could at it, so wearing myself right out, which I did. I found out my limitations over the years, of what they call overtraining. I don't know if any of the guys got to worry about that nowadays, but there was, days that, and this wasn't just one day, this was doing this for 2-3 weeks straight, was, go out and cycle 35 miles and then go and ride a couple tanks of gas through the bike and then go out and either swim or run for another approximately 30 to 40 minutes at a pace that was got your heart rate up there in the red zone. So you do that for 15, 20 days in a row, pretty soon, you're starting to take its toll on your body and you're starting to overtrain. And, you start wondering what's going on. You're going backwards for a little bit, but you're finding out your limitations, your body. So the last school I taught, I went with some of the guys over to some stairs where I used to run, and I was in my suit pants at the time and shoes, and these guys were in their shorts and that, and I'm as out of shape as I thought I was. I ran up and down the stairs a couple times with them just to show them that this wasn't a wives' tale, but this really did happen. So it was a big advantage to me, the training, and those rumors were, I guess, true about me, that I did work pretty hard, and I used to, at the time, like to keep it under my hat because I thought it was a huge advantage for me to be in that type of shape, and I think the other guys that train that hard, Wardy and Omar and the boys, they felt the same way, so we can tell you all our secrets.
Mike Harden told me a story about training with you, and he thought he was in pretty good shape. And then, he'd run a lot and train a lot, and then he started hanging out with you for a couple of weeks, I think back east somewhere, and he was like, I'm not in any kind of shape, like Ross is really whipping me. And then he told me a story about you did some sort of VO2 test in Holland or something with all these GP riders, and you had like the highest aerobic VO2 count or something in the history of this place. Does that ring a bell?
Well, there was actually, I know we did a test in Medicine Hat, where my hometown, or I was home based back then, and I had a heart rate of a highly trained marathon runner. I know that. And you know what's funny was I ran to do this checkup. I ran up to do it, to do this test, and I didn't realize that they were going to be physically testing me there. So I probably ran a couple, 2.5 miles just to this appointment that I was going to. And as I kind of shocked myself, I thought, geez, maybe all this stuff is working. Because, you know, the doctor, he was kind of in wow. He couldn't believe it that I was in that good of shape. So you can't naturally not be in that type of shape. I mean, just riding. I mean, everybody knows what it's like just to go out and ride a couple of tanks of gas through. Heck, I was doing that back when I was a intermediate rider there and junior, just out practicing until I, you know, realized that if you complemented that type of training with some aerobic training, that it even multiplied your ability. So it was always a little secret that I like to keep under my hat back then, but
I know, you know, I grew up in Winnipeg, so Austin was the track that I saw you at, and deep, deep sand whoops, you know, six motos sometimes, most times four, and you would just kill them there. So definitely, I saw where your training came into play, you know what I mean, in that track, so.
Man, back then, I think to myself, four motos or six motos at that track, like back in its day, 4 45-minute motos on that track. Plus practice.
Yeah.
That was the toughest track. I mean, you know, Florida's got some pretty gnarly tracks, but I don't know what it was with the Austin sand, but it was I think it was a finer sand is what made it tougher. It got rougher faster, and the whoops got deeper. It was, you know, everybody talks about Cocoa Beach, how rough it was, and St. Pete back then, but I mean, they were rough, but not like Austin was.
Yeah.
Like, it was bike craters there. Like, you know, the bikes would disappear going down the straightaway, just falling in the hole for that deep. Austin was a gnarly track.
Sirwall told me that Austin was rougher than Cocoa Beach also, because I was with Ferry one time, and I was trying to tell Tim Ferry about this track back at home and how gnarly it was, and he said there's no way it can be rougher than Cocoa Beach. And Sirwall happened to be like 30 feet away, and I called Sirwall over, and I said, Sirwall, what's rougher, Cocoa Beach or Austin, Manitoba? And he was like, oh, Austin by far.
I mean, there's Jeff had certainly rode at both tracks many times, and I don't know what it was about Austin. I think him and I actually had a conversation about this, why it was rougher, and we came up with that the sand was, you know, at Cocoa, it was like a sugar type sand, whereas in Austin it was more of a grain that would be between you know, flour and and sugar. It was like a real fine grain, and it just made it that much tougher. Even the turns were tougher to take because of the sand. It didn't give you as much support, so you'd always want to wash out. Or it was a tough track. It was hell those Sundays.
I was always wondering, in a mid 86 87 you switched to Yamaha from Suzuki, and the only 2 years that you know that you rode pro besides the early years on the Cowie, what made you switch to Yamaha? What was it, just more money, or what was the deal? What happened behind that?
A big reason to switch was Lawrence Hacking. He was team manager back then, and Lawrence was a super guy, and I switched over because of him, and of course John Gale at the helm of the racing division back then. Those two guys were big enthusiasts, and John and Lawrence were great to ride for, and not that I didn't have a good at Suzuki, but these fellas were just a little more even race orientated, and they lured me over there, and I was there for a few years, and then you know how things go. You get lured back by that evil dollar.
So you went back to Suzuki for more money than you were making.
Well, yeah, back then there was a big things had changed a bit even more. We had a bit of a recession back in this is going way back in 88, and yeah. It actually kind of coincides with our recession here in 2008. So it was a little bit better there, and the bikes were all real good back then and competitive. So you just kind of had to go with Marshall Johnson had a big decision on where we went back then, and right. He felt that the Suzuki's were the place to be, so that's where we went.
You don't have to say it, or we can take this out or whatever, but what was like the most money you ever made in your career, like just overall everything?
It's funny how, you know, usually later on in your terms you make the, or in your years you
right.
In your career, you make the most money. It was about the opposite for me. The most money I made was probably back in about 84.
Really?
85,
huh? Yeah. I would have thought it was way later than that, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, they were pretty close, you know, back between 84 and 87. Those 3 years were pretty strong for me. I mean, it's embarrassing to say what you made back then towards what these guys, I see Zetterberg just signed, what, a $78 million deal
12 years.
You know, I'll just take one of those 78 that have been happy back then. I remember the big deal about Barnett signing that three-year contract back then for, what, it was $1 million
or something. $1 million, yeah.
I mean, you know, back in my day, you know, to make, I think back in 85, I made $450,000. I mean,
that's peanuts. Yeah, it's peanuts. But
peanuts towards what the guys are making now. But back then, that was wow. The best you could do for the best motocross would make. And, you know, I know some of the guys in the States made more than that. However, it just wasn't the sport. If you were going to be wanting a big dollar figure, stick with, basketball or baseball, you know, those are the big dollar sports. There was none more fun than ours.
it's really a shame that, like, guys like you, and even Lachine told me what he's made in the past. Like, you got an RJ and Glover. I mean, Glover has a regular job, you know what I mean? He has to have a job, and he's a six-time national champion. So, it just sucks.
It really is, and something, I don't know how, if the governing body should step in or somewhere along the line, and it starts right from the manufacturers aren't paying the guys enough money to start with. What was I reading somewhere that somebody said the 20th place guy should be making $1 million a year, and he should, because...
Right.
They're out there working harder than any other guy in any other sport is. I can tell you that. I mean, I see what, and I know what the guys do when they're, you know, for training, and whether it's, hockey or baseball or basketball. I mean, there's some elite athletes in there, don't get me wrong. However, if you took the overall consistency of hard work, you couldn't beat the motocross,
right?
It's the most physically demanding sport in the world, and there's no gimmicks to it. It's a tough sport. You gotta work hard, and our guys deserve more. Really do. And a lot of greats, as you say, like I'm my jaw's still on the floor here, you saying Brock's working a normal job. I thought if he was, it just was to pass some time, because you know what can happen when we got too much time in our hands, or at least I do. Brock's was a multinational champion, and the guy should be somewhere down in Florida right now just looking over his herd of racehorses or something.
Right.
And, you know, But Brock's done all right anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure. I guess I shouldn't. I don't exactly know his finances, but he does work for Dunlop, and you would think he may not travel as much as he once has to. But anyways, let's talk about that time on your hands that you alluded to. You're not living in the gutter, obviously, Ross. You're doing fine, right?
Yeah, I guess I brought up a new story here.
You kind of did.
Some of the stuff I've heard about, about my past couple of years is unbelievable. At first, I used to get a bit of a kick out of hearing some of the stuff that, I was down and out and living in the gutter. And, the old saying, tell a sentence and send it through 10 people and see what that sentence says after it's gone around the full circle is quite different. And I see how that is live in the real world also. Things are going good for me. I had a little bit of a, shall we call it, a life challenge there, or a hurdle in life to get over. And
a life challenge, I like
too
that.
Much, too much idle time on my hands. Used to the high of winning races for 15 years. I thought I would, try a different high, and it wasn't something that I condone on anybody. It's evil, and you don't want to be involved in that stuff. And,
all right.
I'm glad to have come out of it, and things are going well for me. And Hannah used to say all the time, as long as they're talking about you, it doesn't matter what they're saying, you're still on top. And well, there's one time, Bob, I wish they weren't talking about me, but it's interesting, and I can see how some of these guys that are in the tabloids, I feel for them now, because don't believe everything you read, because a lot of that stuff is bullshit.
All right. So, we've touched on it enough, I think. So was there somebody in, you really spanned a generation in Canada. The early 80s, you had Barini Jr. and Jari Heininen and those guys, and then you had Hoover and Harden, and then you had Valancourt, and even maybe JSR a little bit. Was there one rider, like, all these guys came up to challenge you, and of course we all know that you beat down all of the challenges, but was there one rider that gave you the best run all those years in Canada? Like, somebody that you were like, hey, this guy, was there a second best rider to you, do you think?
Which generation are we talking
any generation you want.
I went through a couple. I feel like my body feels like I went through about six generations out there, but she went through a few waves of several waves of riders that were great riders. And, they must hate me because Peterson wasn't around. They'd have been on top. All I can think. There's some great riders. A fellow that I really admire and got a lot of respect for, and in his day came up against me at my best, really, and that was back in 87, a Canadian rider by the name of Doug Hoover. He was a tough cookie, and he worked hard, and he trained every bit as hard as I did. He knew, and that's funny how how Mikey showed me how to train a bit, and I showed him what shape was. I took that little fella, Doug, out there at the beginning of the season in California, and I took him out riding and running one day, and I showed him actually what I did, and I think he...
big mistake, huh?
That was a big mistake, because Doug, he was... a big-time motocross enthusiast and go-getter, and he went out there and did what I did, and, Dougie had the ability also. He gave me nightmares and fits there in Canada in 87, and actually 86, 87, and he made it tough on me, and I think back, how tough it was on me then, and at that time, that was when I was riding my best ever. I had my best results in the U.S., and he I guess Dougie, he would have been a many-time national champion also if he wouldn't ran into me, I guess, out there. And
he beat you in 84.
He was the toughest. I was really impressed. I mean, Mike Harnden, for the whole, you know, several generations, he passed a lot of generations also of riders, and he was pretty consistent all the way through and was always there to knock on the back door if I ever faltered and won a championship against me in the 500 class. So Mikey was always tough, and you got to go back to a guy that was my hero, Zolli Bereni Jr. He was my hero. I don't think I ever told Zolli that, but him and Tom Gates were big heroes of mine when I was a junior and, you know, before I started racing. Those guys, I can remember standing on the side of the track at Blackfoot watching Bereni and Gates go by, and I turned and said to my father, I said, nobody can go faster than these guys. I still think about that, you know, and then a few years later, I'm racing with them. They were great riders also. So, and there's so many great riders that out there that, you know, you think back and if this and if that would have happened, things could have been totally different all the way around. And I was just lucky enough and fortunate enough that all the cards fell in the right place, Steve. And I had a couple great years out there.
Just a couple. They didn't fall into place in 89 in the bar in Regina. Otherwise, you would have won those three titles too. But
I think I only had to take one title that year on default or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I had enough of a lead, and that was Saskatoon. That was another challenge in my life when I got a little too much time on my hands, shall we say.
Guy
learns from them lessons anyway.
Al has an asterisk behind his titles that year. He's got an asterisk because there was
Al,
no roll.
Al, he was, two-trick was, he was in the right spot at the right time. And then I kind of fell to the wayside and he picked up the slack, you know. And Al was a great rider too, and he deserved a championship. All these guys that I mentioned and lots that I haven't mentioned deserve more recognition than they've got. And, you know, I just... we're coming. Motocross is becoming more national. I'm seeing a lot more of it on TV. And, it's just going to take a little bit of time, but we know what the number one sport is.
See, Ross, I don't think they do deserve the credit. You beat them all. You were the rollerball. They don't deserve any credit. They couldn't beat the rollerball.
I worked a little harder than them. If I'd have told them all, or if Doug would have told them all my secrets out there, they'd all been working harder.
Please. Mitch Payton told me a story, I don't know, a little while ago, that Hicks and Storbeck were all pissed at you because you were riding really rough with them, and you guys were all sponsored by Pro Circuit, and they went to Mitch and said, Mitch, you got to tell Ross, like, you know, he's being a jerk on the track and he's taking us out, and we can't stand for this. You got to tell him. And Mitch told me that he was like, yeah, you guys tell him. I ain't telling him. And then Mitch is like, yeah, they never told anything. The rollerball, they were scared.
So. Riding for Mitch was great back then. I wish I could have slipped a little more under his wing there, if I could have got a little more of, we could have swayed him the Canadian way a little bit more, but he was patriotic and stuck behind the Americans, so I had to rough him up a little bit just to let him know that I was serious. We had a lot of fun anyway.
When Ferry was 16, he was racing the Florida Winter Series, and you were kind of on your way out, and he said you used to hit him so hard. He was like,
you know, it's tough when you're out there and you know it's your last year or two and you got these young bucks, you know, they got no fear. They haven't fallen off yet hard enough to break anything. They've got no fear out there and they're going for it. And you got to just let them know sometimes who the experienced guys is out there and that they should show some respect for their elders. Because, you know, they weren't doing that. And Jimmy wasn't doing that enough with me the last couple of years, so... when I got my chances, I let him know that he should.
And those Florida series, those were good money back then too. He used to tell me that he made really good money at those Florida Winter Series. So
yeah, that they were good money back then. They had lots of contingency behind them, and they were good cash store. So, and you know, Tim knew how much I like to make money, and that's henceforth how we bumped into each other the odd time out there.
Hey, how about that crash in Anaheim '89 when you and Bale came together in the air in that triple? And do you remember that? And you landed on his seat. You were like on his seat when he landed, and you bounced off.
Was that the landing of the century?
Oh, dude.
I still think back about that. And you know what saved me there was just sheer fear. That bike went out from underneath me up in the air when he hit me. And we were going through the air, and I thought to myself, this is landing will probably kill me if I don't do something. So I reached over onto the back of his bike, and I hugged onto him, and I kind of landed side saddle on the back of that bike. That's the only thing that saved me, because we must have been three stories up on that one. And that was back when the triples weren't forgiving. I mean, they were, the third one was peaked, and it was high. And, wow, of course, I got to decide to get off that bike in the highest spot on that treble. So I had to do something there. That was just sheer fear that saved me there.
Was there one crash that you remember that was your best, your gnarliest one? I mean, is there anything that sticks out?
No, gnarliest one? Well, one of the toughest ones was probably when I broke my hip down in San Diego. That one didn't look like much. It was just kind of fly through the air, hit the bank in the bank corner, you know, that 90 degree, and just slide down the bank and then ask the flagman if he could help you stand up. That one was one of the hardest that I've crashed.
That
it
hurt.
Didn't look very spectacular. I'd have to say that one in Anaheim was probably one of the most spectacular, or Endowing in St. Gabriel de Brandon at 500 GP, tapped out in about fourth gear coming up that uphill, and that bike kicking out the back end and doing cartwheels down the top straightaway. That was probably one of the most spectacular. It was definitely a yard sale. That
you talk about the GPs, and the mythical story that I always heard when I was a kid was that you had a GP ride sort of lined up, but then you had your kidney problem where you crash and you lacerated your kidney or whatever. Is that true? Did you actually have a chance at a GP ride?
Well, we were talking over there, and in Göteborg, Sweden, or we pronounce it Gothenburg, I guess, it was the race where I hurt my kidney at, and that took me out of the motocross Dis Nations the next weekend trophy Dis Nations. So I missed that, and that's when they were going to take and look at my results seriously to put something together over there for Germany. So I don't know, who knows, what if this and that happened. It could have, back then the manufacturers in Canada were paying me a lot of money to hang around here, so it was tough. Who knows what would have happened, you know. Could have went on to be a Formula One race car driver if this and this and that would have happened, but you can never know. But we were talking about it anyway.
When you got like those GP rides in Canada at Moto Park and everything, and you were on that RM500 somehow against Works 500 Hondas and all the world's greatest riders, and I believe you got fourth or fifth on a GP. Like, do you remember that day? Was it pretty gnarly to race against those guys on that bike?
Yeah, it was pretty tough. I mean, obviously, we'd be sitting on the starting line, and those guys would, they'd have their water-cooled 500 Hondas and Yamaha 500s, GP bikes, and these things are just like bring as they sit on the line. They're just like crisp and everything. I'm on the line. I can still remember I'm trying to clean out that RM500 wide open, and it's like burbling away.
Vibrating like
hell. Yeah, and, we had a little bit of a machinery disadvantage on that day, but I tried a little bit harder, so it was It was a lot of fun. I'll never forget that. I mean, I can still remember battling with Malherb and Gabor's and that, and my number plate's falling off as I'm going around the racetrack, and silencers falling off, the bike's just disintegrating as we're doing lap after lap in that 40-minute DP.
Yeah.
And that thing just wicked. It was a lot of fun racing against them guys, but you know, in my opinion back then, the Americans were tougher, or
right.
maybe they just had a little more psychological advantage on me being my heroes. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Interesting. Now, talking about the American guys, I'm always interested to know, you went down there so much, and you had some really good results, like third at Hangtown and a fifth at Red Bud, and I think a fifth at Binghamton. And anyways, you were a big part of the American racing scene. Did those guys embrace you? Like, were you, I mean, obviously Holly and you were running mates, but like RJ and Wardy and the Lachine, like did they embrace you as one of theirs, or did you still feel like you were a little bit of a foreigner, let's say?
No, I was foreigner for sure. I never changed from being a Canadian. I'm proud to be a Canadian.
Right.
That was a little bit tough out there. It's, you know, you talking about, you know, Hicks and those guys talking
to Mitch,
to Peyton back then about, you know, he came and talked to me about, you know, not being so rough with him. It was a little bit, I can still remember in Seattle, Washington, Keogh and I had a horrendous battle on the track, and I think Eric might have fallen over in one of the turns by accident or something,
just by accident, right?
Yeah. And anyways, that night my bikes got stolen, and at the hotel that we were staying at, and I knew the next day, I thought, well, there'll be no problems. I'll just get one of the spare bikes from, you know, U.S. Suzuki,
right.
loan me something, and not a chance. When they knew I didn't have any machinery, there's no way they were going to help me out the
really,
next day
huh?
to battle against their guys. So, no, it was, you know, I was Canadian. I don't know what it's like now. I'm sure it's still the same. Americans, they hang together pretty tight, and they don't like finishing second to any foreigners. So they get the Canadian at the back there. They're not feeding him the prime macaroni, shall we say. I was getting the leftovers. So
oh,
if I even got any. But it was a little bit tough. It just made it more fun. And, you know, everybody knows us Canadians. We just try a little harder.
Yeah.
Make it happen.
Yeah, exactly. Do you have to go? You need to go?
I got lots of time, Steve.
Okay, all right.
Talk to me, baby.
Was
I
it?
Never get to talk to you. You only phone me once every 5 or 6 years, so shit, if I get you on the phone,
dude,
I got to keep you here.
I'm too nervous. I get nervous and sweaty palms when I got to call.
Shit. You don't have to be nervous to talk. We can talk anytime we want about anything.
All right. Was there one race in America that really stands out for you? Like, of all the races you've did and all the great results you had on probably subpar machinery, like we were talking about, is there one race in America that really stands out for you that you were like, damn, I was fast?
Oh, I don't know if there's one in particular. There was some motos that were pretty interesting. Waco, Texas, back in oh heck, that must have been about 80. Somewhere around the 85, 86,
mm-hmm.
anyway, back then, I know I was battling the whole race and reeling in Bailey back then, and that was, you know, David was a great rider back then, and he just started with the Honda team, and he was phenomenal. I know that was one race I was pretty happy.
What did you end up getting? Like, what did you end up placing?
Oh, I think what we ended up, we were back a little bit. It was about a fifth or sixth, but it was that, you know, I was with him the whole race, battling with him, and
right.
he's on this great machinery, you know, I'm on a basically production bike. There was, you know, there was many races that I was stand out in my mind. I could go on and on about them.
What about the USGP in Unadilla?
Yeah, Unadilla, you know, racing with the GP fellas and finishing well in those results. That was another race. There was many many finishes at Gator back in Florida that I was pretty pretty proud to have finished. You know, my starts were never good down in the States. Battling against that machinery of theirs always was a little bit better than my production bike with different handlebars on it.
And you were a little bit heavier guy too. You know, you were a bigger guy, so.
Yeah, that might have been it a little bit. Maeda, he had the suspension. Roscoe always worked hard on the suspension, so we had pretty good suspension. But, you know, let's face it, you know, back in those early years, I mean, I was running production bikes against.
Right.
That was back when they were really works bikes.
Sure.
You know, they were full on. You know, some of the machinery back in the early 80s was pretty exotic towards what I was riding, and you know, so to be racing against them guys when they've got, you know, carbon fiber this and carbon fiber that, and you know, technology that's 3 and 4 years ahead of what you're riding, it was pretty proud to have done them. So to name one race in particular, gosh, there were many races that I was pretty happy with, Steve.
Yeah, well, that's probably a good answer. You know what I mean? What about today's race, and how much do you follow it?
I like to keep in touch, you know, with some of the bigger races, Daytona and whatnot. And honestly, I've grown a little bit older, like a lot of our generation, and you know, I've grown away a bit from the sport, and to see some of the stuff that was said and written about me, and honestly, has kind of soured me a little bit at times. I guess when I'm feeling sorry for myself, you know, I get pissed off. I haven't been as tight with it as I should, but right. I can also blame that on myself. You know, you gotta sleep in the bed that you make. So,
when you came back to back onto the scene, it was the early 2000s. You were Blackfoot team manager. That you know, we all know it didn't work out so well in the end. You guys had a philosophy difference, I guess you'd say. But what about those days as a manager? Did you like it? And when you were commentator as well, I mean, what do you think about those days?
Those days were, you know, I really enjoyed helping out Mark. You know, Mark's done, you know, a lot for the sport and putting it where it is in Canada. It was a lot of fun to hang around the guys. You know, again, the travel, and it was still a little bit close to, you know, from my racing years, I was really tired of traveling for 15 years of living out of a suitcase was,
right.
You know, and then it was a couple of years off, and then pretty soon traveling around to the Nationals was a little bit too early to get back into that. So that was the only thing I didn't enjoy, but, you know, being around the races and the crowd and the people that were there, that was awesome, you know. And as you say, I don't know if it was a philosophy difference or what with the Blackfoot team. Mitchell and I, we don't get along too good, and we don't see eye to eye.
Yeah, well, hey, these things happen. When I talked to one of the riders on the team, he when you were managing, that he told me that you were pretty upset because you saw a lot of guys getting tired, and you were like the easiest thing to do is train. Anybody can do that. There's no like maybe you don't have the skill to win a race, but you should never be tired. And you just couldn't wrap your head around the fact that these guys were getting tired.
Well, you know, Steve, there's one thing to have the talent and the ability. You can't just go out and make that happen. But there's no excuse for going out there and being tired when you're getting paid to ride. And you know, that was one thing I got to admit is. You know, the Blackfoot team had, you know, they had second to none out there as far as anything. The motorcycles or any of the equipment they were using was the best out and that money could buy. And, you know, having all that and the backing that that team had, and then to be there on it and not working at it. I mean,
come on,
I used to get a little bit pissed at that, because that there's so many guys I think out there that would have died just to have that position. You know, they work so hard at it, and when you see guys like that with the talent that they had, and just to kind of throw it away, it, you know, there was right. a few of them. We won't mention any names.
No, we don't have to.
Get me a little bit pissed off.
That's what I heard. It was my guy that was riding for them was Jason Thomas in Florida, and he said that you liked him because you knew that he tried, and he tried and took it seriously. And but he said
they worked hard at what he did, and you know, at the end of the day, I knew he went out and gave it 110%. You know, and whatever the results were, that's what's dealt. You know, that's the hand you were dealt that day. But you know, and you got guys that are doing nothing all week, and you know, they're on easy street there, and they're getting half-assed results. So that's what I would be upset about. And Thomas, he works hard at it, and you know, he did well, and he deserved everything he got, and you know, he even deserved better sometimes. But you know, the cards aren't dealt your way.
Was there a rider in Canada that you raced against that you saw that had a ton of talent, but you know, very little, that didn't work at it, that wasn't in shape? Was there a rider that you always thought could have been so much better than what they really were?
God, I don't want to be putting anybody on the spot. I got enough enemies out there.
You know, I mean, you don't got to, you know what I mean? Just somebody that was super talented that maybe didn't do what they, that maybe could have done a lot better.
Oh, gosh.
Because, I mean, let's face it, you didn't have the most natural talent. You know, obviously you had
brutal for talent. I just went out and worked harder than everybody else.
No, Roller, you were talented. Don't give me that shit. You were talented, but you know what I mean. Like,
I just knock them off. They got to go a little too much faster than I was going.
So nobody that you can think of.
Iron them, as Zolly would say, we just got to iron them out a little bit, iron the wrinkles out. I don't know how we can say this here. You know, he's actually come to an untimely accident. Is, you know, Blair. I mean, Blair, I used to look at that guy and see the talent he had. You know, he was, from all the guys I've seen in the world, Blair was one of the most talented best riders in the world. Like, he was as good as any Bailey or Johnson or Hannah, any of the greats. Like, he was an incredible rider, and I saw that from the first time I rode against the guy was at a little Saskatchewan race on the border of Alberta and Saskatchewan. I went out there on a weekend off to go cherry picking, and I think he actually beat me in the first 125 moto we had, and I thought, wow, this guy is, you know, he's fast. I'd never heard of him before. And then, you know, we raced the rest of the day, and I got to battle with him in the other motos, and I saw how great a rider he was. And, you know, I just he used to frustrate me with Blair that, you know, all that talent, I wished he would have worked a little harder at it. And I'm really sorry about his accident that he had, and where it's put him. And gosh, Blair, my thoughts are with you, and man, I know how tough it must be being as great as you were. I never saw you on a snowmobile, but I heard stories of how great you were, and I know the ability you had on a motorcycle. I wished you know, things would have gone different for him.
What about Daryl Martins? What do you remember about him? He's a good friend of mine. So,
Daryl, you know, he was a great rider. I never got to see him as much because, you know, him being in BC, we would run into each other kind of at the Nationals, and you know, I'd get to ride with him. A great rider, also, just really didn't see him as much just because, right, you know, our paths didn't cross as much, but I certainly respected him, and he was a great rider in his day. There's no doubt about it.
Why do you think, like, like you talk about those internet rumors, and like you said, like, you know, if people are talking about you, it might be a good thing, but maybe not. But years later, you've really left a mark on a lot of Canadians, including myself. And I mean, I got some friends of mine that feel the same way that I do. Like, you know, you were such a great champion and such a Canadian motocross legend. Why do you think you resonated with this fan so much? Why do you think you've affected them so much? Was it just, you know, looking back on your career, can you think of one reason why the country would just still be talking about you and still embrace you as, you know, as a champion?
Gosh, I mean, that's I'm honored to hear you say that, Steve. I mean, that's
it's true.
You know, thrilling just to hear that and know that you mean it. I don't know. I guess I'd like to think of it, Steve, as they saw a guy out there that was determined and never gave up, and that's the way we Canadians are: is we battle right to the end, no matter whether we got you know, the best army, whether we've got the best army, we go in and we do it right. It doesn't matter whether we're in World War One, Two, or now fighting over there. Now we go out there and we do it. We make it happen, and I think maybe some of the fans saw that in me racing. It's not always did I have the best equipment or maybe the best luck, but I picked up and took what I had and did the best I could with it. So I would like to think of it as anyway.
Yeah. Well, it's a good answer. No, it's a good answer for sure. So how much money did King's Gear offer you to switch to that gear?
They
must have paid you a fortune to wear that stuff.
They paid me a little bit of money and a good contingency program. It worked out, right? I guess that wasn't your favorite gear that you saw me
no,
wearing.
No, Ross, I wish I forgot about the King's Gear years.
Did that King's Gear leave a mark, a black mark on the...
I don't know. It just when I saw you in King's Gear and I was a kid, I'm like, no, Ross, you sold out for the money.
You did, eh? See, you were a businessman at heart right there. You knew why I did
Yeah, no, I know. I'm bugging you.
Stevie, when you're getting old and you're on your way out, sometimes you got to go for the money. When you start seeing the guy grabbing the money, you know he's on his way out.
Yeah, exactly. It's like an old rock star releasing greatest hits CDs after CDs.
Greatest hits.
Your last year of racing in Canada, you won the titles. You were, I believe you won all three or maybe two. No, you won two titles your last year.
I won 125, 250.
Yeah.
They didn't end 500, but the...
Well, you had that bastard 500 for a while.
That's what it was. They didn't win the Grand National because they didn't have the 500. Was that what it was?
Well, you had that CR500 in an RM250 frame.
Yeah. That ill-handling unit there. The thing was fast, but boy, was it scary on them straightaways. I can remember being down at that GP down in Glen Helen, and we're out practicing that week before down there, and I forget whose bike I rode, and we switched bikes, and they wanted to try this thing, and man, I couldn't get over how their Kawasaki was so,
right.
Would go so straight down the straightaways, you know, and wouldn't, they got off mine, and they were white.
Yeah.
Wondering how I could even ride this thing. The motor was sitting a little high in the frame, that's all.
I bet.
I told him you got used to it after a while.
Like, the thing is like, you could have kept riding. Why did you quit? What, you won titles? Were you just over it? Were you not making any money? You could have kept milking it out. You know what I mean? You know what I'm saying? You went out on top, and I admire that. Was there just something that happened that year that you were like, I'm done?
I'll tell you what. My father, who I think's probably the wisest man that I know, I was going to make a comeback, and this answer to this was the answer to your question.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to make a comeback about 5 years after I retired. I was starting to get bored, you know. I had nothing to do, and I'm thinking, I'm seeing these guys out here riding, and I'm thinking, you know what? I'm going to come back, and I'm going to kick their asses again and show them that this old guy can do this, because I was confident I could do it. And I was I was excited about it, and I'd had a few years off, so I was refreshed. I was ready to go, you know, and a few people told me, you know, like, why, Russ? Why do you want to do it? You don't, you know, it's not for the money. You've won 40-some championships. You don't need any more championships. Why are you going to do it? And, you know, I really wrestled with that because everybody was saying the same thing to me. That's when them rumors were going around that I was going to come back. And I really was. And I asked my father, I says, you know, he says, you know, I said, what do you think about me coming back, Dad? Do you think it's a smart decision? What do you think? And he says the same question that you mentioned to me. Why did you quit? And I thought about that, and it just all came to me. Why did I quit? I got scared.
Wow.
I lost, you know, that's to be flat open and lay all the cards down and show you everything. I got scared to you. It was, you know, them big jumps, like every time I'd gotten hurt, Steve, like mm-hmm. pelvis in San Diego, kidney in Sweden. It all came down to the jumps, like the big doubles and triples. Look at what happened to me in Anaheim. I land on the guy's side of his bike.
Yeah.
I could have been easily deaf or, you know, yeah. The position that David or Blair or, you know, are in right now, you know, a spinal injury very easily.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I walked away with that with, I think, a sprained ankle or something. Like, I mean, I still, to this day, cannot believe that I walked away from that. Like, that was, like, that was crazy. Like, and how many more of those was there that I've forgotten about? There's been so many, you know, crashes like that that I've walked away from. And I, you know, more guys were getting hurt, you know. David at the time with his, you know, his injury, and all these guys started getting hurt. Magoo with his injury, you know, and that's something, Stevie, as you know, would you ever, I don't know how these guys do it, you know, to be so great as where they were and so free and so wild and, you know, just, you know, to be in confined to where they are. Steve, I'm if there's anything I'm scared of, like the rollerball, if there's anything he's scared of, I wasn't scared to mix it up with anybody, but I was scared of getting hurt that way, being limited to something. Steve, that's what happened, and I got scared, and I said I was going to do it one more year, and that was it, and I wanted to retire on top.
Mm-hmm.
Steve, I can remember... in Quebec, I was sure they would do this. So this is when Valancourt and I were, you know, in the last couple of years. And they knew I didn't like jumps. And every time we went to a Quebec race, they would have them fucking national jumps would be just ugly. Like these doubles there that were just like, I can't even believe they're putting this on an outdoor track. Like they were crazy doubles. I can remember at a race out in... Valley Junction, every lap, I'd get over that jump, and I would, you know, it was just like a sigh of relief.
Right.
I made it.
Wow.
We'd do the next half of the track, and three corners before this jump, I would start thinking, oh, my God, I got to do this one more lap.
Wow.
One more lap, and it was like that. That was the whole frigging day I was doing that. I was scared of this jump, and it was like there was only a few experts making it, but, you know, to be battling up there, you had to do it, and not to do it, it would cost you, you know, a couple seconds a lap. You had to do it every lap, and you imagine this ape on a 125 out there. Like, I'm just like, well, you know, I got my asshole puckered and then lifting on the handlebars and foot pegs, you know, to make it over this jump, and I'm doing it every lap. I just, you know, just sitting over a crash in San Diego from a broken pelvis, and after a while, all them crashes add up, and in all honesty, you know, I was a little gun-shy. I was getting gun-shy.
Yeah, you could just see the French bulldoze operator just piling the dirt up, going, "We've got the rollerball this time."
I'm sure Valancourt was paying him. Like, I was convinced of this. You know, I was like, "Fuck, these guys are, they know I hate jump, so track is just jump infested." You know, and you know, nowadays the kids grow up on that stuff. That's what it's all about. I mean, I grew up on an, like, I'm a motocross guy. Unadilla, my favorite track. That's me. Nowadays, you know, Stevie, when I see these guys, if you told me a guy did a flip on a motorcycle, I'd tell you you're full of shit. I'd tell you it's impossible. You can't do it. When I see this, unless I actually physically saw this with my own eyes, I would think that's not possible. That's trick photography or whatever. Can you believe that they're doing flips on motorcycles?
I know.
Flips on snowmobiles. What, a double blast, a double flip on a snowmobile some guy was doing?
Yeah.
Did you see this? I'm going to email you this. You got to give me your email address. I'm going to send you this jump. Did you see that over in France where the guy jumps up, I don't know, 10 stories or something onto the top of this building by the Eiffel Tower and turns and jumps off it?
No, that was in Vegas.
No, was that in Vegas?
Yeah, I went to that jump. It was in Vegas.
Okay, it was Vegas. I thought it was over in France.
Well, no.
Somebody sent it to me on the internet.
Yeah, it was at a hotel that was made after Paris. It's got an Eiffel Tower. It's got a Champs-Élysées. It's a replica of Paris.
Wow, dude, can you believe that?
I went to it. I was standing there. I was 30 feet away.
Wow. Was it that?
He hit the red.
That takes some guts to do that. That's number one.
Yeah.
That takes guts. But when I see these guys going through the air, hanging onto the rear fender, or doing a flip on that motorcycle, that's not guts. That's talent. Talent, no brains. Like, there's so many different aspects of that. Like, that really wows me. Like, that is, that blows me away.
Hey.
I mean, what that guy did in Vegas was...
Yeah.
Wow. Hey, you know, you're a pretty ballsy guy, but these guys that are doing what they're doing now, this extreme stuff is...
Hey, you were ahead of your time. You grabbed onto Bale's rear fender in the air.
Bro, I can remember, you know, back in the day where guys thought you were crazy if you took one hand off the handlebars.
Oh, I know.
Or if you did a no-hander, you were out of your frigging mind. That was like... Guys shook their head. They couldn't believe that.
Dude, I went to...
Could you imagine coming from that era where doing a one-hander was a big deal? Like, you were somebody if you could do that.
Right.
To where guys are hanging onto the rear fenders doing triple jumps, you know, hanging onto the rear fender playing Superman?
Yeah.
Like, Stevie, like, we've come from the grassroots to this insane stuff, and we've seen everything in between. It's absolutely phenomenal how much the sports changed in the last 20 years.
One of my favorite memories as a kid, and I literally probably saw you race 20 or 30 arena crosses all across Canada because my dad would drive me there and I would race the 80 support class, or later on I would be a pro, but... My favorite memories is you and the radical jump. You would do the same move every time. You would twist your bars, kick it out, put the one hand up, and you would win every time because it was crowd applause, right? So you would always win because we were in Canada. So
that was a big deal, eh?
I know it was. And like, the biggest thing was like no leggers. I remember Lachine used to do no legger. You know, it was like a big deal.
and now you see these guys and it's like, if you can't do a flip on your motorcycle, you're nobody.
Yeah, exactly.
You know? Like, can you believe we've come to that?
No.
Like, Stevie, what is going to happen and what's going to be down the road 10 years from now?
I don't know.
We don't. Like, you think of a guy like what DeCoster has seen.
We're working on getting you out to Toronto, and wait till you see James Stewart ride. Just wait till you see that kid ride.
I've heard he's like, I mean, comical. I mean, he odd meet in Daytona the last time I was down there.
Right.
I think that was back with Blackfoot back in 2000.
Right.
He awed me with his ride at Daytona, how strong he was, how good he was. He awed me, and I heard Stewart is supposed to be even better than that.
He's just more talented, you know what I mean? He just does more things with the bike than Ricky ever did. So it's
Wow, that must be something to see.
It's unbelievable. What advice would you give to an up and coming rider? Like, you know, if you had somebody come to you, you do these schools now and you work with kids and I guess you work with some adults too. But what's one piece of advice you would give an up and coming rider? Anybody listening to this?
One piece of advice, stay determined, stay focused, and don't ever give up.
Just like your career, huh? All right. Well, hey, thanks for doing this, Ross. I appreciate it.
Stevie, anytime I can help you out, bro, or do anything for you, I'd love to come to Toronto and be with you guys down there. And anytime, I love being, you know, back around the race. It's tough for me to come, you know, to go to, like, I didn't go to the Nationals this year, Steve, just because, did I want to? Yeah, of course I did. I want to come out and see everybody, but I didn't want to come out and be embarrassed a little bit, about what's being said in that. I miss you guys, man.
Yeah, we'll work on that. I just want to be there when you and Holly start swapping old stories. That's all.
That would be so awesome, Stevie. it'd be great, and I'd love to be there and be with you guys. I don't want to hurt the sport in any way, and I'm a little bit embarrassed. Well, I'm not a little bit. I'm a lot embarrassed of how far it went with me on the bad side. I wish it wouldn't, because I've let a lot of people down, and I'm just a human being, man. I've made my mistakes too. I do make mistakes, and I did.
Yeah, that's exactly it, Roller. Everybody, you know, makes mistakes, and we're all human. And well, some would say that you were maybe superhuman, but that might be me.
Thanks, bro. You got to be my biggest fan,
dude.
I love you.
No, I just, I mean, like I tell people, like I tell, I live in the States now, and I talk you up, and actually, I have a bunch of pictures of you on my website that'll be launched probably next week, but.
Right on.
You were the guy. I mean, you were it when you were a Canadian kid and you were a fan of moto. To me, you were the guy. You know what I mean? So that's
to hear a guy of your stature and knowledge and where you're at now, Stevie, to say something like that. That's it makes me feel really good inside, man. You make me feel
Well, good.
I've gone through a lot of turmoil in the last couple of years here, Stevie, and that's why you haven't seen me around the race. And that I'm being honest with you, I'm embarrassed.
Nah.
From what's said, it's easy for you to say, don't worry about it. But I'm embarrassed to have not only have I let you down or my fans down, but I've let myself down.
Well, that's all right. Hey, we all screw up. Let's just keep going forward, right? Let's just look forward.
Yeah, like I said, stay focused. I'm getting back focused. Like I say, I'm going to do these schools, and all I can do is, and all I can say is, is I'm sorry, and I'm going to make it right, and like if I can save one person from that shit, man, let me know, and I'll fly from here to New York to give somebody a lecture on it.
Right.
I would.
All right.
To save one person would be worth it. And thanks for being behind me through these tough times, Steve. I appreciate it, and I really do mean that from my heart. And
well, cool, Roller.
I don't.
This is much of an honor for me, as you know, for as anything I've done, honestly. So I'm pumped to be able to call you up.
I'm looking forward to seeing you, Stevie, and it's gonna be an honor just to sit down and having a Canadian Labatt flight or something over some bullshit section with Holly.
Great. Well, thanks again, Ross, and I'll be in touch.
Okay, bro.
Thanks.
You take care and call me anytime.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, bud. Bye-bye.
Wow. There it was. The Ross Rollerball Peterson podcast. So thanks everybody for listening. I don't even know what to say anymore. I'm at a loss for words. That was awesome. That was great. That was awesome. I sounded like a little bit of a fan, but whatever. I don't care. Quit bugging me. Like I said, thanks for listening. I appreciate it. It's times like these podcasts that really make me enjoy doing my job. So look for again for next week for Racer X podcast, directmotocross.com podcast. And thanks again for listening. See you next week.